This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. Wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. And this is the November 2023 Literature Review Series. Lucky to be joined by two special guests, RJ Mendoza and Brock Townsend. And the November Literature Review Series episode starts off with our featured studies, where we highlight six of the most notable publications from the month. Then the discussion shifts to cardiology, a potpourri section of sorts focusing on precision medicine and infectious diseases, followed by the category featuring articles voted on by you, friends of the pod, in the pharmacist featured section, aka the front of the fridge. Now, if you want to vote in future episodes, be sure to follow on Twitter or Instagram at Pharmacy2Dose. Then the episode closes with our non-clinical section, some sweet emotion. Now, one highlight is the November pharmacotherapy issue on precision-based medicine in the adult ICU patients. Multiple articles from this great themed issue are highlighted on today's episode, so be sure to listen. Thanks to all for participating in the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness Bracket. Now, what's next on the horizon, you may be asking? Be thinking about awards. Who to nominate? We're building off an incredibly successful 2023 awards season, and we're back in 2024 and looking to be even better. So much more to come on that in the near future, but get your thinking caps on. We have great articles to highlight with even better guest hosts. So here we go. And very lucky to be joined by two special guests for our November 2023 Literature Review Series, and that's RJ Mendoza and Brock Townsend. Now, Brock is the PGY2 Critical Care Pharmacy Resident at the Wesley Medical Center. You can find him on Twitter at Townsend_PharmD, and RJ is the PGY2 Critical Care Pharmacy Resident at the VA San Diego Healthcare System. That's nice. Brock, RJ, how are you two doing today?
I'm doing great, Nick. Excited to be on the pod today. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Nick. And it was good to see you during the SCCM conference. And you too, Brock.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to shout out to the listeners. So the famous RJ who brought the Filipino sweets, which, by the way, on the pod update, I actually have a Filipino aunt. She ate the whole box, loved them. Well, the box left over of what we had. So you made multiple people very, very happy with that. So greatly appreciated, my friend.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad you and your aunt enjoyed it as much as I did. Thanks.
So starting this episode off, as we do every Literature Review Series episode, with our featured articles. And this month, it's a six-pack of important publications. And in the Tuesday recap of the 2024 SCCM Congress, Melanie Smith-Condenny mentioned that she liked a trial based on its name alone. So, Brock, highlight this first study in our featured articles, researching empiric treatment with a concentrated blood-derived component.
So, in trauma-associated coagulopathy is a major complication among trauma patients. One important aspect of this coagulopathy is fibrinogen, which is broken down into fibrin strands, helping to form stable blood clots. Fibrinogen is often low in trauma patients due to fibrinogen consumption and fibrinolysis, and low levels of fibrinogen are associated with increased bleeding and mortality. In current practice, fibrinogen is often only replaced in later stages of transfusion if fibrinogen levels are low or if testing such as thromboelastography indicates fibrinogen depletion. Cryoprecipitate is the most common form of fibrinogen replacement in the US, and it is administered in pools with one pool of cryoprecipitate containing approximately 2 grams of fibrinogen. Several studies, including the initial cryostat study, have shown early administration of cryoprecipitate is feasible, but there is limited evidence supporting benefit in patient outcomes. Cryostat 2 was a multicenter phase 3 open label parallel group randomized trial conducted at 26 trauma centers in the US and UK, aiming to identify if early empirical cryoprecipitate improves mortality. The intention to treat analysis included 1,531 patients aged 16 years and older who sustained severe injury and had massive transfusion protocol initiated. 80% of patients were men, median age was 39 years old, median injury severity score was 29, and approximately 80% of patients received TXA prior to the hospital. Major exclusion criteria included presenting more than 3 hours from injury. Injury is incompatible with life and outside hospital transfers. The control group was managed with standard massive transfusion protocol targeting a 1-to-1-to-1 replacement with packed red blood cells, fresh frozen plasma, and platelets. In the intervention group, patients were administered 3 pools of cryoprecipitate within 90 minutes of admission, in addition to the standard massive transfusion protocol. For the primary outcome of 28-day all-cause mortality, there was no difference between groups, with a mortality rate of 25.3% in the cryoprecipitate group and 26.1% in the standard of care group. When looking at the subgroup analysis, there was actually a significant increase in mortality among patients with penetrating trauma in the cryoprecipitate group, with 16.2% mortality compared to 10% in the standard of care group, indicating further research may be needed to find the patient population which would benefit from this intervention. Among other subgroups and secondary outcomes, including safety and thrombosis, there were no differences. Ultimately, the results of this trial do not support early empirical cryoprecipitate administration, and I think I would recommend utilizing testing such as thromboelastography to guide product replacement in this population.
Yeah, great review here, Brock. I certainly agree about TEG. The irony that they don't necessarily utilize viscoelastic testing, but then they used Rotem findings to, that's how they validated and created this dose, this empiric dose that they gave, which is kind of ironic there. Even in those centers that don't necessarily utilize viscoelastic testing, this clearly argues against empiric cryo, right, as a component of that MTP. You could tell, right, you mentioned it was 26 centers, US and UK, so 25 UK and 1 US centers. And I think you can, tell us without telling us, and it's because almost every patient in both groups received tranexamic acid, right? A huge difference in practice. And I think this kind of goes along with the other empiric blood-derived component administration, not necessarily blood-derived component, but with the PRO-COAG study, right? We need a patient-specific or even precision medicine approach. Well, remember that phrase, we'll come back to that a little later. When managing our critically ill hemorrhagic trauma patients, right? Even if our viscoelastic testing is unavailable, even if it is, the idea that this should be combined, probably not. But a really good article, really fun research study to say. And our next study follows our November featured article trend of incredibly fun acronyms to say. This one you just have to say with a French accent. So RJ, highlight this study researching aerosolized antibiotics in the ICU.
Ventilator-associated pneumonia, or VAP, is one of the most common nosocomial infections in the ICU. It poses a significant burden on patients, and it is associated with increased mortality, antibiotic use, duration of mechanical ventilation, and overall healthcare costs. There have been several trials in the past that suggested inhaled antibiotics, such as gentamicin, tobramycin, ceftazidime, and colistin, could prevent VAP via the delivery of high concentration of antibiotics to the lungs. That is why the authors of the AMIC Inhale trial, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, evaluated whether preventive inhaled amikacin can reduce the incidence of VAP. The AMIC Inhale trial is a multicenter, double-blind, randomized controlled trial that was conducted in 19 ICUs in France. It included critically ill adult patients who underwent mechanical ventilation for at least 72 hours. Key exclusion criteria included 96 hours or more of pre-enrollment mechanical ventilation, suspected or confirmed VAP, patients with severe AKI not requiring CRRT, patients with CKD, or those who are receiving systemic aminoglycoside therapy. The AMIC Inhale trial is a very unique trial because aminoglycosides are typically administered via intravenous route, except in cases of refractory MAC pneumonia or cystic fibrosis, where aminoglycosides can be administered via inhalation. Patients in the trial were randomized to either receiving inhaled amikacin dose 20 mg per kg via ideal body weight once daily for 3 days versus placebo, which is nebulized normal saline. The primary outcome was the first episode of VAP during 28 days of follow-up, while the secondary outcomes included infection-related complications as well as adverse events. Of note, the trial was not powered to assess mortality or hospital and ICU length of stay. The definition of VAP that they use in the trial is a little bit different from our definition here in the United States. They define VAP as a positive sputum culture with at least two findings of either leukocytosis, leukopenia, fever, or purulent secretions with a new infiltrate on chest x-ray. That is compared to the U.S. definition, which takes into consideration an increase in oxygen requirements or a change in mechanical ventilation settings. 847 patients were enrolled from July 2017 through March 2021. Baseline characteristics were pretty similar between the two treatment arms, with an average duration of mechanical ventilation before randomization at 3.5 days. All three daily nebulizations were received by at least 80% of patients in both groups. For the primary outcome at day 28, 15% of patients in the amikacin group versus 22% of patients in the placebo group developed VAP, which was statistically significant. In terms of secondary outcomes, infection-related complications occurred more in the placebo group compared to amikacin group, with no significant difference in serious adverse events. And lastly, in terms of microbiological findings, in the amikacin group, almost 50% of the isolates were GNRs, whereas in the placebo group, it was 66%. Interestingly, one-third of all isolates in both groups were GPCs. Overall, the AMIC Inhale trial suggests that a three-day course of inhaled amikacin could significantly reduce the burden of VAP among patients undergoing mechanical ventilation for at least 3 days. The result of this trial could definitely change clinical practice, potentially leading to the adoption of inhaled amikacin as a preventive measure for VAP. However, clinicians should carefully consider the benefits and risks of preventive antimicrobial therapy, and further research is warranted to validate the findings before we start implementing this approach in the United States.
And of course, you had to use a French accent because it's a French study. So the listeners, if you're curious like me, how in the heck do you aerosolize 2 grams of amikacin, right? So you think 20 mgs per kg, ideal body weight, you're somewhere between 1 to 2 grams, right? Just like on that, just a quick eyeball. So, you know, We've highlighted before how international resistance patterns can be a little uglier, right? One of the big things with the Mercy Trial, for example. But that wasn't the case with the Amick and Hale study. I can't do a French accent for those wondering. But there was only around 5% of MRSA or ESBL, right? A lot of those resistant infections that I would have expected to see. So they did, you know, you highlighted all those bugs they grew. I kind of expected them to be nastier with amikacin. And there's a really, there's an important point from the supplementary appendix that I want to close out this with. It highlights the issue with kind of ID research in general, but one of the considerations from this study. So the authors, they state, to conduct a trial likely to show a reduction in the duration of mechanical ventilation by inhaled amikacin, one would need to include a sufficiently large number of patients who benefit from the intervention. What does that mean? That means patients who would develop VAP in the placebo group, but not in the intervention group, which would require an inclusion of a very large number of patients, most of whom will not develop VAP in either group. So kind of highlights one of the issues with power calculations, confounders, and things with ID research. But really great. I mean, great work from these, from this French crew here. I just need to know where this amikacin dose came from. So if anyone has any idea, 20 mgs per kg, ideal body weight, aerosolized, I would love to know. You know, it's cool because the appendix also, they give it as a 50 ml syringe. It's over 17 ml an hour. So it's a 3-hour aerosolized treatment. That's kind of wild. Now, most of us have heard the phrase GCS less than 8, need to intubate, right? It's kind of a common one. Now, the study I'm going to highlight next challenges that famous mantra. So one or more of the common presentation after an ingestion or intoxication is a decreased level of consciousness. And the reason many of these patients get intubated, right, is for airway protection. You limit the risk of aspiration and or pneumonia. The article notes, like we know, we just described two things. Those are complications from mechanical ventilation, right? RJ just went through a whole study looking at something we could do to try to prevent VAP, right? We know pneumonia can come from that ventilator. So French researchers designed this multi-center, unblinded, randomized, parallel group trial comparing routine practice to a strategy of withholding intubation in comatose acute poisoning patients. So this was the NICO study, great acronym, published in JAMA. And the trial took place in 21 sites, 20 of which were French emergency departments. So essentially an emergency department study. And adult patients with a GCS of less than 9 and a suspicion of an acute poisoning were enrolled. Key exclusion criteria included the immediate presence of an indication for intubation, say they were immediately in shock, immediately hypoxic, or they had a suspected cardiotoxic medication ingestion, right? Beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, we know that management falls into a completely different category of things. Now, after randomization, if patients in the intervention arm developed what they said was a, what they defined as an emergency intubation criteria, things like a seizure, hypoxia, shock, they could be intubated. And then patients in the control arm, they were intubated at the discretion of the treating emergency medicine physician. Now, patients were monitored or treated according to the study, their study intervention for up to 4 hours or when their GCS recovered. So the primary outcome was a hierarchical composite of in-hospital mortality, length of ICU stay, and length of hospital stay. So they utilized the Finkelstein-Schoenfeld, I promise I did not make this up, the Finkelstein-Schoenfeld method to compare patients, and they used all three composite outcome components, but they are in a hierarchy of their clinical importance. So mortality, ICU length of stay, and then hospital length of stay. Complicated stats here. I just skimmed the surface. That's all I'm going to get into here. But if you are very much into stats, this may be the study for you to take a peek at. 225 patients were enrolled from May 2021 through April 2023, so just about 2 years. And around two-thirds of patients presented with acute alcohol ingestion as like their primary intoxicant. And when you look at simple intubation rates alone, it was 16% in the intervention arm versus 58% in the control arm. And out of the 19 patients in that intervention arm intubated, 16 had an emergency intubation criteria, which means only 3 out of that 120-some actually got intubated without like a true classic indication. Now, the primary outcome was reduced with this intervention arm, But when you think about that hierarchical composite outcome, you probably blacked it out already, bring it back. It was mortality, ICU, and hospital length of stay. Well, there's no mortality in this study. So it essentially showed that when you're not intubated, of course you reduce your ICU and hospital length of stay. So I don't know if I necessarily interpret the primary outcome the same, but it definitely shows clearly that that phrase, G-CIS less than 8, need to intubate, maybe not so much anymore. So very cool, pragmatic research idea. Also notable, right, in the control arm, it wasn't 100% of them were intubated. Only 58% were intubated. So this is research to support an idea, right, that looks like we were maybe starting to nudge or practice in that fashion in the first place. It's not a huge secret that we're constantly looking for new and improved DOAC indications. Brock, highlight a study researching this specific treatment in our neurocritical care population.
Yeah, so historically, recommended treatment for cerebral venous thrombosis, or CVT, has included unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, and warfarin. Direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, have been studied, but current evidence is limited to small or retrospective studies. RESPECT-CVT was a small randomized trial which showed no difference in outcomes between dabigatran and warfarin. And ACTION-CVT was a retrospective observational trial comparing DOACs, which included apixaban, rivaroxaban, and dabigatran, to warfarin. This study showed no difference in VTE rates and actually decreased major hemorrhage risk among the DOAC group. The SECRET trial, which compared rivaroxaban to standard of care and published in Stroke, was a phase 2 randomized, prospective, open-label, blinded endpoint feasibility trial. Their goal was to assess the feasibility of recruitment for a large clinical trial to generate preliminary data regarding safety and to assess prospective functional outcomes. This feasibility trial design is important because it can be difficult to conduct a large prospective trial with a rare disease state that has low event rates. Patients were randomized in a 1-to-1 ratio to either rivaroxaban 20 milligrams daily or standard of care, which was either warfarin with an INR goal of 2-to-3 or low molecular weight heparin. Patients were treated for a minimum of 180 days and up to 365 days. Randomization occurred once the patient was deemed suitable to transition to anticoagulation by the treating clinician. Adult patients were recruited across 12 comprehensive stroke centers in Canada within 14 days of confirmed CVT. Notable exclusion criteria included anticipated invasive procedure, such as thrombectomy, or a creatinine clearance of less than 30 milliliters per minute. 55 patients were enrolled from March 2019 through October 2021, with 53 ultimately being included in the modified intention to treat analysis. 66% of patients were female with a median age of 48 and a median time from diagnosis to randomization of 3 days. Among the standard of care group on warfarin, a majority of patients were therapeutic, with 84% of INRs throughout follow-up in the 2-to-3 range. The primary feasibility endpoint was the rate of recruitment, which was 21.3 patients per year. In this study, there was low consent rates at just over 50% and low event rates, indicating a massive study across dozens of centers would be required for an adequately powered clinical trial. The primary safety outcome was a composite of all-cause mortality, symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, and major extracranial hemorrhage within 180 days of randomization. There was no difference between groups for this outcome. One of the things I liked about this trial is that the authors did not require any lead-in parenteral anticoagulation period. Where previous studies required at least 5 days of parenteral treatment, this trial didn't, with 62% of patients being enrolled and started on oral anticoagulation within 1 to 4 days. Up until recently, DOACs had no formal recommendations for use in CVT. However, in January, the American Heart Association officially recommended the use of DOACs or warfarin for the treatment of CVT, citing similar safety and efficacy outcomes. I did think it was interesting that they recommended DOEX as a class and didn't list any specific agents that they recommended. AHA also recommends at least 5 to 15 days of lead-in parenteral anticoagulation prior to transition to oral anticoagulant agents. I would like to see future studies not require this lead-in parenteral anticoagulation, similar to how the SECRET trial was performed. While we might not have the highest quality of data since we're lacking these large randomized controlled trials, this study shows that it would take a lot of resources to be able to conduct such a trial and may not be feasible. I've seen some providers at my institution in the past couple of years starting to utilize DOACs, and based on the available data, I think I would also feel comfortable recommending the use of DOACs for patients with CVT.
Yeah, the AHA scientific statement that Brock, that you appropriately referenced, published in the journal Stroke, right? Kind of quoting, they specifically state that DOACs appear to be a safe and effective alternate option to VKAs, according to open label, retrospective, and prospective randomized studies. So it almost feels like you're recommending, but you're not. You know, you were we're putting all the different caveats. And you know, in that statement, similar to the SECRET study, you know, you mentioned they didn't require the 5 days of lead-in like previous studies did, and those previous studies are probably why guidelines recommend that. But the mainstay is still parenteral. You still start with parenteral. We're not giving rivaroxaban down in the ED. Interesting that it's not the VTE treatment dose that we're doing the, you know, the 15 BID for 3 weeks into 20 a day. We're kind of starting just the 20 a day. Certainly growing evidence for the use of DOACs in this population. I'm always with anticoagulation in the brain. I'm always like a little hesitant. I think we're getting more and more stuff. This makes me feel better, but once we have the confirmed, right, once we kind of advance past the feasibility thing, then maybe they'd get me on team DOAC. But for now, I would say I'm also like the guidelines and I'm team on the fence. An area with expanding evidence for treatment in the critically ill is patients who have or develop hepatorenal syndrome. And excited for RJ to discuss this and more with a BPA from a national governing body.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. The American Gastroenterological Association, or AGA, recently published its best practice recommendations for vasoactive agents and albumin use in cirrhosis based on published literature and expert opinion. The use of vasoconstrictors and IV albumin is essential in managing complications of cirrhosis, such as variceal bleeding, spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, and hepatorenal syndrome, or HRS. This first expert review issues 12 best practice statements related to the most common complications of cirrhosis, including the newly FDA-approved medication for HRS, terlipressin. So let's highlight some of the most pertinent information to pharmacists. Best practice statements 1 to 3 focus on variceal bleeding, specifically detailing the safety benefits of octreotide compared to somatostatin and other vasopressin analogs such as terlipressin. It is recommended that IV octreotide treatment begins immediately and continues for 2 to 5 days to prevent rebleeding. Although terlipressin has been evaluated for variceal bleeding based on several clinical trials in the past, the FDA does not include this indication, whereas in Europe, terlipressin is accepted as initial treatment for variceal bleed. Recommendations on the use of albumin for ascites and spontaneous bacterial peritonitis remain the same, but the authors specifically detail in Best Practice Statement 7 that vasoconstrictors should not be used in the management of uncomplicated ascites, post-large volume paracentesis, or in patients with spontaneous bacterial peritonitis because of insufficient evidence from small clinical trials. The section with the most changes is the HRS management section, which details the use of vasoactive agents like terlipressin and norepinephrine. Best Practice Statements 10 to 12 highlights that terlipressin, brand name Terlivaz, which is a synthetic vasopressin analog, is the preferred drug of choice for HRS with concurrent use of albumin. Based on the results of the confirmed trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine, the initial dose of terlipressin is 1 milligram terlipressin acetate-free base, which is equivalent to 0.85 milligrams of pure terlipressin, administered IV bolus every 6 hours for 3 days. The dose could be increased to 2 milligrams or 1.7 milligrams of pure terlipressin every 6 hours on day four in case of insufficient response, as defined by less than 30% decrease in serum creatinine from baseline. Treatment is maintained for up to 14 days and can be discontinued after 24 hours if patients achieve two consecutive serum creatinine levels less than 1.5 milligram per deciliter. Terlipressin is generally safe because it can be administered via peripheral line without central line, and it does not require ICU level of monitoring. However, terlipressin is contraindicated in patients with hypoxemia and those with ongoing ischemia because it can cause respiratory failure and life-threatening ischemic events. In summary, the new AGA recommendations offer comprehensive guidance on the use of vasoactive agents in managing complications of cirrhosis, including the newly approved FDA medication for HRS, terlipressin. I'm excited to start using terlipressin in my practice as I haven't used it yet. In fact, we are in the process of procuring the medication in our institution, so I'm looking forward to managing patients with HRS using terlipressin and other complications of cirrhosis using the agents that we mentioned.
Always exciting to have good evidence for treatment with new kind of fun pharmacotherapy. I'm on the same page. I haven't seen this agent used personally either. Looking at it simply from a hospital use implementation perspective, very interesting the last recommendation that you pointed out, where they say very clearly it does not require ICU monitoring and can be administered via peripheral line. That is somebody saying, don't you dare let this patient take up an ICU bed just for this infusion. Great clinical practice update published in the journal Gastroenterology. If you're interested in this HRS topic, may possibly be, but definitely am working on an HRS and terlipressin episode. So stay tuned for that. Closing out our six-pack of featured articles is a randomized trial evaluating a pharmacologic intervention in our most vulnerable patient population. So, in patients who are ultimately declared brain dead, some will go on to become organ donors. And one of the most common treatments recommended in these patients as they're preparing for this is an IV levothyroxine continuous infusion. Like if your hospital has this unit, it's almost like a rite of passage, you seeing that, having questions, talking through it, that sort of thing. And in theory, why do we do this, right? Brain death can create a neurohormonal imbalance. And the thought is that when you have thyroid hormone deficiency, this could lead to shock and quote unquote myocardial energy depletion. So these US researchers essentially wanted to challenge this recommendation, right? They noted that some of these earlier studies, they looked at surrogate outcomes and they were underpowered for things such as organ utilization, right? Which in this population would be like mortality and our others, right? It's the number one thing that you're worried about and trying to help. So they created this trial to test the hypothesis that IV levothyroxine would increase the rate of hearts transplanted from hemodynamically unstable brain dead organ donors. So this was a multicenter, unblinded, parallel group randomized trial, which took place in 15 organ procurement organizations, or OPOs. And they enrolled hemodynamically unstable patients, meaning those requiring vasopressors or inotropes, between December 2020 and November 2022. Now, quick note, not saying anything about the researchers themselves, but not everybody puts all of their trial characteristics in that initial run-through. Example, They didn't put unblinded. The researchers didn't in this trial. You have to see it a little bit later. So just a little tip for those when you're reading these literatures, right? The devil is in the details. Now, getting back to this study, so patients were randomized to IV levothyroxine at 30 micrograms per hour infusion or a matching placebo, and the assigned treatment lasted 12 hours. Now, the primary outcome was, like we just talked about, successful transplantation of the donor heart, with the safety outcome looking at 30-day graft survival and no difference seen in any of the baseline characteristics of the patients enrolled. And ultimately, the authors found no difference in that primary outcome between IV levothyroxine treatment or placebo. No difference in the primary safety outcome or any of the secondary outcomes such as total organs donated or time to vasopressor weaning. So really important research, right? Challenging common intervention doesn't have great data supporting it in what you would argue is one of our most vulnerable populations, like I said, right? You know, looking into an intervention to see how much, if at all, we're helping our brain dead organ donors, right? Some of our most important patients. So a really great research published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Well, that was a fantastic six pack of featured articles. In November 2023 really brought the heat. So RJ, hang back a second because Brock is going to lead us through his cardiovascular featured articles while he works on not breaking our heart. And Brock, go ahead and lead off this section comparing two of our favorite non-catecholamines in the treatment of vasoplegic shock.
In catecholamine refractory vasoplegic shock associated with cardiopulmonary bypass, treatment options focus on the reduction of a vasodilatory mediator, nitric oxide. To date, research comparing agents targeting nitric oxide haven't found any differences in patient outcomes. So this pharmacist-led author group out of Cleveland published the hydroxycobalamin versus methylene blue for the treatment of vasoplegic shock associated with cardiopulmonary bypass trial in the Journal of Cardiothoracic and Vascular Anesthesia. They evaluated change in vasopressor requirement and mean arterial pressure over time following the study drug administration. This retrospective cohort analysis included 120 post-CT surgery patients requiring higher than 0.2 micrograms per kilogram per minute of a norepinephrine equivalent catecholamine vasopressor dose. In the hydroxycobalamin group, all patients received 5 grams, while dosing varied with the methylene blue. Both groups demonstrated significant reductions in vasopressor requirements and increase in MAP at all time points following administration of each agent. After adjusting for baseline characteristics, a significantly greater reduction in vasopressor requirements and increase in MAP was noted in the hydroxycobalamin group. However, this did not translate to an improvement in patient outcomes. Ultimately, it appears both medications are effective for the treatment of vasoplegic shock. Based on the results from this study, and given the more standardized dosing and potentially fewer severe adverse reactions, I may personally lean towards recommending hydroxycobalamin over methylene blue in these patients in the future.
This feels like one of those scenarios where if you look hard enough, you can probably find positive studies for both agents in various forms of vasodilatory shock, whether it's vasoplegic or septic shock. You know, they have the chest article that showed some improvements in hemodynamics when giving the hydroxycobalamin. I mean, if you're making it at the bedside time to treatment, you know, that tends to be a fixed 5-gram dose. You got the vial, you make it. It's methylene blue, you have weight-based. Some it's like a piggyback over 30 minutes, some it's like an infusion, some it's continuous infusion, right? So many differences, it's harder to make. Two reminders when we're thinking about using, right, hydroxycobalamin or vitamin B12, right? Reminder from the August 2023 literature review series that high dose B12 can interfere with labs, so keep that in mind. And never be too proud or confident in your skills. Always put on gloves, or people will know for a week that you made hydroxycobalamin at the bedside and spilled it. That's same with methylene blue, both of them. Don't be too proud. Gloves are your friends. So let's shift into a different perioperative problem, but one that actually affects your heart rate rather than blood pressure. So Brock, take it away.
So data from small randomized studies have suggested colchicine, an anti-inflammatory agent, reduces perioperative AFib in patients undergoing cardiac surgery. But questions still remain whether this anti-inflammatory treatment could reduce perioperative complications after non-cardiac surgery. So this international randomized placebo-controlled study titled COP-AF, published in Lancet, compared colchicine and placebo on the occurrence of perioperative AFib and myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery, or MINS, in patients undergoing non-cardiac thoracic surgery. The intervention arm received low-dose colchicine, defined as 0.5 milligrams by mouth twice daily for a 10-day treatment course. Over 3,200 patients over the age of 55 receiving general anesthesia for major non-cardiac thoracic surgery were enrolled. There was no significant difference seen in the co-primary outcomes of rates of perioperative AFib or MINS. However, as we would expect, there was an increase in non-infectious diarrhea among the colchicine group. Based on this well-done study, I would not recommend colchicine to reduce perioperative AFib or MINS in non-cardiac thoracic surgery patients.
Yeah, of course, most of us probably remember one of the biggest side effects from colchicine is, of course, that GI intolerance, or I don't know if it's eloquently, it seems a little grosser, non-infectious diarrhea. I don't know why that seems grosser when they just say it like that, but I don't, it feels like it is. But it makes sense that was a significant difference that we saw. Some data on this use in cardiac surgery, right? But not necessarily others like our non-thoracic surgery here. So this is good research to review, kind of showing that this theory maybe doesn't apply to all of our patients. Now let's shift into talking about most cardiologists' favorite anticoagulant. And that is, my guess is apixaban. I don't actually know that for the record. And I also didn't know that the US FDA and the EMA, essentially Europe's FDA, they recommend different dosing strategies or dose reductions for patients with both atrial fibrillation and severe CKD. So when we think of dose reduction, you know, ours, of course, is, you know, you need two of the following, right? Age greater than or equal to 80, body weight less than or equal to 60 kilos, or creatinine greater than or equal to 1.5. Man, but Europe makes it easier. It's just 15 to 30 in your creatinine clearance. So that's kind of nice. Now, what this massive retrospective database multi-center cohort study did was compared the two different apixaban dosing regimens in patients who had AFib and CKD stage 4 or 5 that were new apixaban starts, and they compared the risk of bleeding and systemic embolism, including strokes. So they compared, of course, I should have said this earlier, our standards 5 milligrams BID and that reduced doses. It's not five once a day, it's 2.5 twice a day. So 4,300 patients were analyzed, and the higher dosing regimen was associated with a significant increase in bleeding without a difference in that systemic embolism. So interesting data to consider, especially considering most apixaban trials excluded these patients, right? If your creatinine clearance was less than or equal to 25, you weren't in a lot of those big studies. So I'm guessing we may see more to come here. So that's kind of an interesting study. So Brock, go ahead and close out your cardiovascular article reviews with a comparison on routes of administration for treatment of a diuretic-induced adverse effect.
So the 2022 AHA/ACC heart failure guidelines recommend IV loop diuretic treatment for hospitalized patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. However, there is no discussion on the preferred route of administration for adjunct diuretics. So this pharmacist-led author group out of Austin, Texas, published the study IV or oral acetazolamide for treatment of diuretic-induced alkalosis in patients with heart failure in the Annals of Pharmacotherapy. This multicenter retrospective study compared serum CO2 reduction between the two different routes of acetazolamide administration in 70 patients also receiving high-dose loop diuretics, defined as 120 milligrams of IV furosemide. The primary outcome looked at first BNP following acetazolamide administration. IV administration significantly lowered serum CO2 in the first BNP compared to oral administration, with a reduction of 2 versus 0, respectively. However, this did not maintain significance at 48 hours. Based on this study, IV administration of acetazolamide resulted in more serum CO2 lowering within 24 hours. However, the serum CO2 lowering effect among both groups was small, which makes me question the clinical significance of this intervention that I see all the time.
Yeah, I completely agree. And they note that IV dosing was more often one time or pulsed dose to acetazolamide, and the PO group received scheduled dosing. So curious, would that change what we saw? But then when you look, they both received a median of 500 milligrams a day. So is it a dosing thing? Maybe it's a frequency thing if you did it twice instead of once. Maybe timing. I would have loved to see time to diamox, time to from like admission to acetazolamide, because I think that's important. Were these patients trying to get oral acetazolamide at 36 hours after a heart failure exacerbation admission? Probably wouldn't be the best, but if we're looking at 96 hours, I'm pushing for a lot of things to go to PO at that point, unless they're super overloaded. So, but good point. Great article, great highlighting. We're looking in, kind of thinking about precision medicine, looking in specific patient populations like here. A great article here. Now, closing out our Don't Break My Heart CV section is an article examining the causes of what actually happens when your heart does, in fact, break and stop. So, hand up, probably my favorite paper in the whole review. And it's a resuscitation letter to the editor exploring how we came up with the H's and T's, right? Thinking about those causes of cardiac arrest. Sit there, think about it. There's a 100% chance, I'm willing to say 100% chance, that you have either asked someone about H's and T's or someone has asked you about them. And if you're in medicine or critical care, I would be willing to gamble my paycheck, my normal full-time paycheck, which is a joke because I don't work full-time. So these Italian and German researchers, right, they tried to get answers from the European Resuscitation Council. Nope. How about the American Heart Association? Nope. Even the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation, or ILCOR. No answers. So in 2023, when this article was published, where do we go if we don't know the question? Yep, ChatGPT. And unfortunately, our AI companion was used and still no real answer. So it sounds like social media and good old-fashioned research saved the day. So they found the phrase correctable causes was used in a 1986 ERC guideline. And think about it, H's and T's are our correctable causes, right? But there's no mnemonic there. So then it led to a reference that finally answered the question. Listen to this rabbit hole. Kudos to this author group. So it came from a ALS work group in the ILCOR. And Professor Walter Cloak, I think I'm saying that correctly, Cloek maybe, when discussing possible causes of cardiac arrest and specifically PEA, he suggested a memory aid of five H's and five T's. It was then published in Resuscitation in 1995, and now we're here today. So really cool that these authors finally identified the man responsible for our H's and T's mnemonic. And the cool thing is, if you pull this article, remember all these articles that we talk about are in the reference list with links. But when you look at that, they actually include the initial graphic of like I guess it was like our first iteration of Chemo Man. This is like Cardiac Arrest Man. And it essentially has the on this stick figure essentially, or this body, all the different areas throughout, like the H's and T's through it. So they highlight the original image. A very, very cool, very fun article to help uncover the history of this famous mnemonic. What was a line. That was a really good one. It was a great article. Now for the next section, I want to spend most of the review highlighting articles from the November issue of Pharmacotherapy. And the theme was precision medicine in the adult ICU patient, featuring two amazing guest editors, Jeff Barletta and Jason Roberts. And where else to start than with Bill Dagher and his article on the development of precision-based multidisciplinary pharmacotherapy management plans in the critically ill? Wow, say that five times fast. And he highlights where to get started in this article, but you may be wondering, what even is precision medicine, right? So it's essentially individualized care. Many of the trials that we've highlighted, right, even one in this very episode, the Cryostat 2 trial, right, looking at Empiric Cryo, you're looking at protocol-based care for all. And what we've highlighted in episodes with multiple guests, multiple literature review series episode, is that this one-size-fits-all, especially in the critically ill, is going to the wayside. It is not the way of the future, what things we should be doing. Where we know ICU patients break the mold in so many ways, they need this targeted, individualized treatment, right? So what I love about this article is table one, and specifically Bill Dagher highlights 8 quote-unquote skills to consider when developing a precision-based pharmacotherapy management plan. But it's things you wouldn't necessarily expect. Like, it's look at the big picture, where to start. You know, it lists considerations, approaches, as well as even some comments like tips and tricks from the man himself. But there's 2 specific things I want to highlight because I want everybody to go pull these articles and look at themselves. It's an unbelievable themed issue. The first is communication and avoid practicing in a silo. Engage with other disciplines, get their input, and be cautious with one-way messaging. I never heard it phrased like this, but it's responding to someone via text to change the plan without any discussion, right? In a sense, it would be like, hey, the MRSA swab was negative. We need to DC the VANC, right? Now, that's probably an easier example, but it's a one-way discussion, right? There's no real or a one-way recommendation. So I thought that was, I never really heard that phrasing before. And communication is so key, right? I think so much of our issues is assumptions and lack of communication. So the other issue or the other skill to highlight is the modification of assumptions. We all have assumptions, be aware of them, but follow up, right? Things that he highlights, was that medication actually given on the MAR? We know it's ordered, right? Are they getting it? Are they skipping it? Are they refusing it? You know, they were supposed to get dialysis yesterday. Did they get their full 4 hours? Did they end up going at all? You know, and then practical things. And I think these are things that a lot of people learn when they actually go into practice, right? Like, you know, we're taught, okay, you're monitoring antibiotics. If you vanco trough levels, you ideally want to get it 30 minutes beforehand. Well, if you're 30 minutes beforehand is right at shift change, guess what? You need to find a new plan because it's not going to get done, right? And so it's things like that of making sure that, you know, your assumption that it has to be 30 minutes before every time is just not necessarily the case. So again, one example, but this article is a goldmine. It literally goes into detail on different factors that can affect the safety or efficacy of a pharmacotherapy regimen, medication-related, disease state-related, even organ-related. So awesome. And not the organ trail, like organ as in like organ in your body, for the record. So let's move from an overview into a look at approaches in specific classes of medications. And we'll still use the help of Bill Dagher, as well as a friend of the pod, friend of the guest of the pod, Brian Gilbert from Wesley Medical Center. And this article reviews the use of precision-based medicine in anticoagulation. And my favorite part of the article is that the article just sprinkles in clinical pearls throughout the full text on how these subject matter experts develop their precision-based plan. I'm going to give you one example because, again, I don't want to give it all away. These are some of my favorite parts of it. But you know, when they talk about anticoagulation initiation, they say, hey, one thing that you could do when you're developing this plan is start with a standard plan based on guideline recommendations, maybe a heparin drip, and modify it. So say you want to start a heparin drip in somebody that's a high bleeding risk. Okay, you look at what your standard is. Maybe you reduce your bolus, or maybe you reduce your infusion rate. Maybe you hold the bolus. Maybe you get a PTT or anti-10A level 2 hours after instead of 4 or 6 to just see what your trajectory is. So the other point is the article, I don't think it's necessarily split into 2 parts, but when I read it, I can kind of see 2 parts. And the first is kind of more clinical focused considerations, whereas the second part I think is kind of considerations with implementation. And it's when you're looking to do these management plans, what are ways to make it the most effective that you can, right? They use the example of avoid practicing in a silo because there are other factors that could be driving bleeding and or thrombosis, right? Just not anticoagulants, but that's what we're thinking about as pharmacists, right? So anticoagulation, precision-based management is challenging. Lots to consider. This article full of our subject matter experts absolutely helps. Remember, all these are in pharmacotherapy in that month of November. And do you think we could review this information and not discuss precision-based fluids and vasoactives? And we are joined by even more subject matter experts to help us out, Seth Bauer and Brian Erstad. And this time, they utilize a narrative review to help provide insight into the choice of fluid or vasoactive agent. They look at initiation, titration, or de-escalation during that stabilization and de-resuscitation phases of shock. The other thing that they note, all these are research priorities according to the Surviving Sepsis Campaign Research Guideline or the committee. So keep in mind, a lot of these things they're talking about here, these are also priorities for us that our sepsis governing body has kind of identified. Such a great article. Everyone definitely needs to go read. I want to highlight two things. The first is a table. And the table is describing why there may be differences, why we might not see differences between the balanced solutions and abnormal saline in the large randomized trials, right? If you're familiar, we really only saw that huge benefit with the SMART trial. It's essentially, like, if your team balanced fluids, it's essentially like notes to help win an argument with somebody who loves normal saline. So unbelievable. You're literally, like, getting to hear, like, argument points from subject matter experts, not arguments, y'all know what I mean. But one of the author's conclusions as well, the other thing I want to highlight is significant preclinical work coupled with novel clinical trial designs will be necessary to establish the role of precision medicine approaches to fluid and vasopressor management. You know, one of the things as we switch our guidelines to a grade methodology, it's difficult to implement precision medicine and recommendations in those guidelines because the evidence to support them isn't as high quality, right? That's kind of like the ID article where to truly get power for some of these populations, you would need large, large numbers, and that's just not necessarily feasible. But three fantastic precision-based articles, an overview, anticoagulation, and the use of fluids and vasopressors. So we got to give another great job, great shout-out. A claps all around to PharmD guest editors Jeff Barletta and Jason Roberts, right? That November pharmacotherapy-themed issue, Precision Medicine in the Adult ICU Patient, rounding out this themed issue in our potpourri section. It's an analysis into our augmented renal clearance population, and it's specifically an international multicenter study, again, featuring many practice-changing pharmacists, and they're specifically researching the effect of different body weights used in the Cockcroft-Gault equation compared to a measured creatinine clearance, i.e. urine collection. And those different body weights, you may be wondering, right, that may be ideal body weight, adjusted body weight, actual body weight, right? And we all know, depending on sizes, those could be wildly different between them. This is a great idea. The measured creatinine clearance, right, urine collection, unless you have it really protocolized in your unit, everyone's looking for a way not to do it. So we can validate something that we don't necessarily have to do the measured creatinine clearance. That's great. So they looked at almost 400 patients from a 10-year time frame. Now, all those patients had a measured creatinine clearance during their ICU admission. They're at risk for augmented renal clearance. And the first notable point, 60% of patients at risk for augmented renal clearance had it in those who had the measured creatinine clearance. Feels really high. That was the good news. Bad news, unfortunately, all the body weights used in the Cockcroft-Gault creatinine clearance equation had low correlation to the measured creatinine clearance. So highlighting not only the prevalence of the augmented renal clearance, but the need for that modified or measured creatinine clearance to accurately diagnose in those at risk. So getting more and more to help identify those, but you know, the more data we're getting, the more it seems like we certainly are under-recognizing this phenomenon and are critically ill. And rounding out our potpourri section is a double-blind feasibility randomized controlled trial studying metabolic acidosis treatment with sodium bicarbonate in the ICU in an international population entitled, get ready, because this is actually a great name, the SOTA-BIC pilot RCT. They enrolled the adult ICU patients receiving vasoactive treatments with a pH of less than 7.3. Patients were randomized essentially to a sodium bicarbonate infusion or placebo. Now, ironically, it was a pilot feasibility trial, but it was stopped early due to low enrollment. But they met their predetermined key objectives, so despite low enrollment, still fulfilled that pilot RCT. 30 patients enrolled. And their results kind of showed what we know with bicarb, right? And made their pH better with no difference in outcomes. So this study published in Critical Care Medicine, I expect, since it's the pilot, probably more to come here, but not necessarily anything this area is going to change my practice with sodium bicarbonate treatment. So RJ, come on back, because I have a fever, and the only cure, my friend, is more ID articles. And go ahead and lead off our discussion, highlighting a new guideline for the management of the critically ill.
Yeah, Nick, I don't know about you, but I feel like it's getting hot in this podcast series. So speaking of getting hot, the SCCM and IDSA just published its new guidelines in evaluating fever in the ICU, updating the previous 2008 version. The task force utilized grade methodology to answer 26 PICO questions for evaluation of new onset fever in adult non-immunocompromised ICU patients. So let's review some of the most important consensus recommendations. When monitoring and measuring temperature, the panel stressed the importance of accurate temperature measurement methods, such as using a bladder catheter or esophageal probe, or if unavailable, a rectal or oral thermometer will do, noting that axillary or tympanic membrane thermometers are less reliable. The panel also suggests avoiding the use of antipyretic medications for the sole purpose of reducing temperature, except when patients are uncomfortable because of their fever. For febrile patients with pyuria and if UTI is suspected, they recommend replacing the urinary catheter and obtaining urine cultures from the newly placed catheter. In terms of blood culture collection, the panel emphasized the importance of obtaining at least two sets of blood cultures from different sites to improve accuracy and reduce contamination. For fever and new upper respiratory infection symptoms, the panel recommends testing for viral pathogens and COVID-19. And lastly, the panel also suggests checking a procalcitonin or CRP levels in patients with low to intermediate likelihood of infection, unless the probability of bacterial infection is deemed high, in which case they do not suggest measuring CRP to rule out bacterial infection. So there you have it, folks. These are the new recommendations from SCCM and IDSA. I hope as pharmacists, we'll be more vigilant in evaluating the causes of fever in our ICU patients and recommend appropriate medications and lab tests to rule out other causes.
RJ, anytime we've managed to squeeze a Nelly reference into our literature review series, you know that we have done our job on this episode. And need to give a shout out second author, pharmacist friend of the pod, Ernest Alexander, doing huge work in these guidelines. You know, a lot has changed since those 2008 guidelines, very important document. And, you know, this is just another thing, right? Antimicrobials are not antipyretics, right? So a lot of things to consider when thinking about our management of fever in the critically ill. So we started off in the ID section, but I think now we're going to move into our cefepime corner here with these next few articles. And RJ, let's start reviewing some research about a common antibiotic and start off with the study that makes the case for cefepime-based precision pharmacotherapy.
Thanks, Nick. Looking at cefepime from a pharmacokinetic point of view, this new study published in Pharmacotherapy from the Bloom Study Group characterized factors associated with inadequate cefepime exposure in the first 24 hours of critical illness. This single-center prospective study included 100 adult ICU patients treated with a stable cefepime dosing regimen from November 2018 to August 2020, but excluded those patients with AKI, those treated with renal replacement therapy, and those that have undergone ECMO. Researchers then develop a pharmacokinetic model to estimate cefepime concentrations over time for each patient. They calculated the percentage of time the free drug concentration exceeded 8 milligrams per liter in the first 24 hours, or also known as percent FD greater than 8, or simply percent FT. They chose 8 milligram per liter because it is the minimum inhibitory concentration for bactericidal activity of cefepime against Pseudomonas species. The results of the study showed that 70% of patients had less than 100% FT during the first 24 hours of therapy. This means that cefepime did not reach the minimum concentration required in critically ill patients. Factors such as lower SOFA score, higher eGFR, and CNS infection were also associated with lower percent FT, indicating inadequate antibiotic exposure. The median percent FT for cefepime during the first 24 hours was 85%, and the average dose that patients received was cefepime 2 grams IV every 12 hours. In summary, this study highlights that cefepime concentration is inadequate in a significant proportion of critically ill patients, especially during the early phase of critical illness. Hence, it is important to conduct strategies to improve antibiotic exposure and enhance therapeutic outcomes in this vulnerable population without increasing the adverse effects of the medication.
Hey, you could make a pretty good argument that we have some of the most evidence for precision-based pharmacotherapy with antibiotics in the critically ill, but it's such a challenging population to study. So need to give a re-shout out like RJ did to this amazing research team, the Bloom Study Group. We will hear more from them before this episode is finished. Now, RJ, let's move into a discussion on how achieving goal cefepime PK/PD parameters can affect patient outcomes.
Yeah, remember the definition of sepsis, which includes a suspected infection and increase in SOFA score? Ideally, antibiotics should be administered within 1 hour of sepsis presentation per the Surviving Sepsis Campaign. Well, there is a new retrospective study published in Critical Care Explorations that evaluated the association of daily cefepime concentrations with change in SOFA score and vasopressor requirement. This is because there have been small studies in the past that found that adequate exposure to beta-lactam antibiotics improved patient outcome using therapeutic drug monitoring or TDM. The study is an analysis of two previously published single-center data sets from January 2016 through May 2021, featuring a pharmacist author group. They included adult ICU patients who received cefepime for culture-confirmed gram-negative pneumonia or bacteremia and had cefepime TDM via serum concentration monitoring. Daily cefepime exposure was generated, and PK/PD parameters were calculated using the mixed effect modeling to account for patient variability. A total of 394 patients were included in the SOFA analysis, and 207 patients were included in the vasopressor analysis. The results of the study show that achieving cefepime concentrations above the minimum inhibitory concentration for 100% of the time was associated with a 0.006 microgram per kilogram per minute decrease in norepinephrine equivalent dose. Since cefepime is a beta-lactam and it follows a time-dependent killing, time above MIC is very important. However, this is such a negligible decrease, which might not be clinically relevant in practice. In terms of PK and PD parameters, cefepime did not have an impact on the daily change in SOFA score. So based on the results of this trial, I probably won't adapt this yet to my clinical practice. We technically don't have to measure cefepime concentration since it does not affect SOFA score and vasopressor requirement. However, before implementing routine therapeutic drug monitoring of cefepime in the ICU setting, I would like to see hard outcomes such as ICU length of stay and mortality rate, in order to improve patient outcomes overall.
I definitely agree with what you're saying from an efficacy perspective. I would say there are still times from a safety perspective I may want to see a cefepime concentration, but good job reviewing what I would describe as complicated statistics. Ooh. Shout out to all the University of Florida pharmacists on this research study. And let's close out our cefepime corner with an encore. I told you, the Bloom Study Group's coming back, and their research published in the Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy Journal. And this study, briefly, it analyzed different eGFR equations and predicted their accuracy using creatinine, cystatin C, or both. And cystatin C was a important predictor of cefepime clearance when they were calculating it in this PK mixed effects model. So if you're not already familiar with this marker of kidney function, creatinine's still the only one your go-to. probably start to get a little more familiar with this. I sat and see is that could be coming into your system, into more of our things very, very quickly. This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. And we have arrived to the crowd favorite, the section voted on by you, the listeners, the pharmacist featured articles in the front of the fridge. Okay, now we're in the trust tree, right? So with all the voting in the March Madness bracket, I never actually put the articles up to let you, the listeners, vote. So instead of talking through three, let's highlight all nine briefly. That's right. My mistake is your reward. So let's get into it. And article vote number one features three articles with a renal or endocrine focus. So the first is a critical care exploration study featuring friend of the pod, Aaron Barreto, retrospectively testing the ICU obesity paradox in CRRT patients. So they found that obese patients with a median BMI of about 36 had increased survival at 90 days, but similar at 30 days. Now, moving to an Annals of Pharmacotherapy article, we also got another friend of the pod, Francisco Ibarra, retrospectively comparing a standardized approach for IV insulin infusions in hypertriglyceridemia management. So before the protocol, it sounds like it was the Wild West with providers ordering any type of IV insulin that they wanted to get started. It could be for something like DKA, but you know, having a standardized approach and looking at post-implementation of that, it led to a significant improvement in those who achieved a triglyceride level less than 500, no difference in adverse effects. So a really great example of the effect that we can actually be making at our institutions. And then closing out this article, vote one, is an incredible pharmacotherapy review article, Practical Considerations for Individualized Drug Dosing in Critically Ill Adults Receiving Renal Replacement Therapy. So they review appropriate nomenclature, differences in renal replacement therapy approaches, before they do a deep dive into antimicrobial dosing principles. Save this now, because I can't think of many articles that are more zip drive worthy than this PDF right here. Now, shifting to article vote number two, this is going to focus on emergency medicine articles. And first, the T-Box is an American Journal of Emergency Medicine article featuring two friends of the pod, and I know two friends in real life, Caitlin Brown and Alicia Mattson, retrospectively reviewing their use of Endexin Alpha in factor 10A inhibitor-associated upper GI bleeds. And it demonstrated about a 60% efficacy in terms of good hemostatic efficacy according to that Endexin 4 criteria, with almost everyone receiving low-dose Endexin Alpha dosing protocol. Now, close behind is the narrative review and primer for pharmacists on non-trauma uses of viscoelastic testing in critical care. So, published in JACCP with a who's who author list, including Brooke Barlow, just the best, and then two of our favorite UGA C3 members, Susan Smith and Trisha Brannon. Now, for our visual learners, a great graphic comparing Rotem and TEG machines, and figure two that incorporates which products to give based on TEG tracing results kind of within the TEG tracing image. That's a must add to peripheral brains. I hear it getting printed and laminated already. And last, but absolutely not least, we're back to the American Journal of Emergency Medicine, where pharmacist researchers from Sarasota, Florida, described the low rate of adverse effects from the administration of undiluted levetiracetam in the ED. They looked at doses up to 4.5 grams. So great info to help support others in their journey for undiluted IV push Keppra implementation. I'm not gonna lie, this is actually incredibly fun because wow, is there some great publishing going on? And closing this out, article vote number three, it focused on a pharmacist professional development and non-clinical topics. So kicking off the fun is a JACCP narrative review on the role of artificial intelligence or AI in pharmacy practice. So It's a must read to help understand how this growing technology, how's it going to affect healthcare, and then describe the purpose of AI within pharmacy practice. So lots to learn in this realm. Now, next is an AJHP article with a group of Michigan pharmacists describing their implementation and evaluation of a diversity, equity, and inclusion pharmacy resident recruitment strategy. And kudos to these authors because not only did they describe their strategy, but also lessons learned, key takeaways, and next steps. Just awesome. Paving the way, set the example for others to try to be doing the same. So we're looking to become more inclusive in the pharmacy world. Closing out our extremely full front of the fridge section is another AJHP article describing how creating a personal brand strategy can elevate a new practitioner's career. And in the digital era, this article is chock full of good advice, things to do and not to do. So really great article from the New Residents Forum in AJHP. Wow. Strong work, team, because this was a great set of pharmacist featured articles published in November of 2023. And closing out our November 2023 literature review series, we have our non-clinical article of the month. And this month, the trial is more interesting than getting into your feelings, I would say. It's a systematic review in critical care, and they compared findings from positive single-center studies with subsequent multi-center randomized trials. So, there were 16 trials that were single-center that had a positive result with a subsequent multi-center study that were published in New England Journal, JAMA, or Lancet. So, out of those 16 trials, right, because they all have multi-center RCT follow-ups, 14 of the 16 had neutral findings, and only one multi-center study confirmed the single-center findings. So 14 were once referenced in guidelines, 6 have now been removed. So if you look at those, I'll give you two classic examples. The ALIVE trial that looked at amiodarone versus lidocaine. The ALPS trial followed that, of course. And then the LUVIN-1 study looking at blood glucose control with nice sugar following that. So crazy to see the facts detailed like that. Really interesting. And if you're listening, that's why we review articles on the Literature Review series, help you all keep the literature straight. And with that, what a way to end our November 2023 Literature Review series. Couldn't have done the episode without two very special guest hosts. So another huge thanks to RJ and Brock for their help, time, and expertise. Greatly appreciate both of you. Thanks so much for coming on and collaborating, friends.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting us, Nick. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. I had a blast.
So reminder, Brock is on Twitter, RJ's on Instagram. Reach out to both of them. Let them know what a great job this was that they did reviewing all these pertinent articles from November 2023. The reference list with all the articles we discussed and more will be in that podcast episode description, as well as the website, pharmacytodose.com. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.